Hey there, welcome to our podcast for Thursday, October the 3rd. Very busy show. We kicked it off with a buddy of mine, Dan Lavallo, who has ridden in a B-17. He did it a few years ago at Brainerd Airport in Hartford, this much like the plane that tragically crashed, injuring and killing passengers and crew members a few days ago. We talked to an author who thinks there's a war on history. It's just not being taught the way it should be. In the 4 o'clock hour, State Senator Eric Berthel joined us. He is one of the legislative members behind a move to let a limited bear hunt take place in Connecticut because of an explosion in the population of black bears and the danger to people. In the 5 o'clock hour, we got a return visit from Quinnipiac University law professor Bill Dunlap on the impeachment process so far, what's happened, what could happen. And we also, very importantly, found out during the Thursday show that you apparently can't blow up birds with Alka-Seltzer.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
Yeah, that's us. Hey, how are you? It's that time of day again, that time of the hour, 2:07, coming up on 8 past 2 o'clock. This is a Thursday edition of Connecticut Today right here on WICC 600 on your radio and online on your digital device at WICC600.com. How are you? Paul Pacelli here. Thanks so much for joining us again. We appreciate that. We know you have choices, and we do appreciate it. Aaron Johnson on the other side of the glass. And, of course, we're 203-333-9422. Going to get right to a guest right off the hopper here because of time considerations, but before we get there, want to pass this along to you because this is very, very important. Reports popping up, and this one courtesy of the folks at News 12 on their website. Mosquitoes in Stamford have tested positive for the deadly triple E virus, Eastern Equine Encephalitis. The state's mosquito management program announcing the findings earlier today. So once again, triple E has been detected in mosquitoes trapped by the state in Stamford. Those mosquitoes were trapped back on the 23rd of September. This the first time mosquitoes in Stamford have tested positive for the deadly virus. No word of any human cases, though, in Stamford. So once again, if you're going out, folks, I'm telling you, no more shorts. You got to wear long sleeves and or have a jacket, a thick jacket with long sleeves, which shouldn't be a problem now because of the cold temperatures, mosquito repellent, and a high hat. So, triple E found in Stamford. Let's get right to the phones and bring in an old buddy of mine. You probably heard him around Connecticut doing talk shows, but I wanted to have him on because he has ridden in the past in one of the same types of planes that went down tragically in Hartford yesterday, killing now at least seven people and wounding several others. Dan Lavallo is with us. Dan, my friend, how are you today?
Good, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing well. Doing well. Dan, I know you're busy. Thanks for joining us. Now, you actually, and I know you posted pictures on Facebook of this, and I remember when you and other friends of ours did this. You did this how long ago, Dan?
I did. This was in the fall of 2011. And first of all, let me say that my heart and thoughts and prayers go out to the victims who are now starting to be identified and the families of those victims. It's just a tragedy. But in the fall of 2011, as part of a promotion, I was part of a group which got on a B-17 at Brainerd Airport in Hartford. We took off. And we flew for maybe about 20 minutes and returned to Brainerd. And what I remember was how, first of all, tight the quarters were. I gained so much admiration for those who had to be part of that flying fortress during World War II, how tight it was to get in, and then how loud it was. Those were the two things which stood out the most for me, the tight quarters and how loud it was being on that plane.
I mean, those are, Dan, in relative size to the plane, and I've never been near one. You, of course, have been near one and flown on it, as you just said. Those are four pretty big engines there, those prop engines that not only have to get the plane off the ground, they had to get it off the ground with a full complement of soldiers and a full complement of armament and machine guns as well.
You know, it's one of the reasons we won the war, the B-17. But what was fascinating to me, and I've been reading newspaper accounts of what happened yesterday in addition to following the accounts in the electronic media, they got it right. When you got on the plane, you had to sit on what was a bench-like seat. There weren't individual seats like you would have if you got on a plane today. A bench-like seat up against the shell of the plane, and you had to wear a seatbelt as the plane took off. But once we were airborne and we were cruising, we were free to stand and walk around, which was what I did. It was fascinating to be able to walk around and look out over downtown Hartford in this case and experience, at least in a very small way and certainly not under fire, experience what those who were on that plane had to experience during the war. It was quite a machine, and it's sad to see what happened yesterday, but I'm so thankful that I was able in a small way to experience riding on a B-17 8 years ago.
Dan, do you know whether or not, do you recall whether it was this same organization, I guess this Restoration Society out of Massachusetts, was that the same outfit that brought these planes into Brainerd?
It sure was, and as I recall, I had to sign a waiver before getting on, which I had no problem doing.
Sure, yeah.
And you know, signed the waiver, got on, and experienced what, to me, was one of the thrills of a lifetime, to be able to be on a B-17. And like I said, I've always had admiration for anybody who served our country, but for those in World War II to get on that B-17 and fly over Germany and fly as they're being hit and struck by the enemy, and to do their job under tight quarters is just an experience I'll remember for the rest of my life.
Dan, when you were, you know, when you signed the waiver and obviously you're looking at the plane, did the people from the foundation, did they go into the restoration particulars of this? I believe it's the Collings Foundation, because obviously you're looking at a plane, and we talked about this on the show yesterday, that is, at least in some way, shape, or form, you know, about a 70-year-old aircraft or so, and I don't know to what extent, Dan, you know, the original stuff was still on that plane, airframe and everything. Now they're concentrating on one of the engines. But they say that these things oftentimes in battle flew on maybe three or even two engines. So, you know, they're concentrating maybe on some pilot error here. We'll find that out from the NTSB. However, did they go into the how much of that plane was exactly original? Did they get into the restorative process at all?
You know, that's a great question, and as I recall, they did not. I do recall later having someone on my radio program, and they talked about the restoration process, but just in general terms, not in detail. However, I would say this. I would go on one again tomorrow from the foundation, because let's face it, we live in a world where there has to be some trust still, even what goes on in this day and age. And I've got to think that this is a foundation that went through just about every piece in restoring these B-17s. And so my trust and faith is still in them, and I would go on a B-17 that they restored again tomorrow. This was a sad thing that happened. I don't think there's any doubt about that. It's a tragedy. It happens. However, I don't think it should diminish what this foundation has done, and hopefully what it will continue to do, and that is enable people to experience riding in a B-17.
Yeah, and hopefully we will find out what it is, and yeah, hopefully this organization can go on and offer these rides, which, you know, Dan, are not cheap, but people will pay to do this to, you know, have a little bit of a flavor of what maybe their father or their grandfather went through, or some uncle in the family who, you know, maybe doesn't want to talk a lot about this. But I would imagine, as you said, you're up there. It's much the same feeling I had when I visited, unfortunately, one of the German concentration camps several years ago. And I was walking around there saying to myself, what must the horrors have this been like where I'm standing, you know, 70 years ago? I'm sure you thought about the same thing as well.
Oh, absolutely I did. You know, it's interesting that you bring up some of these points, because yesterday I was talking to someone who works in the medical field who was going to go on one of these B-17s, and you're right, it's pricey, but this was always a dream of his to ride on a B-17, and the only reason he didn't go was because it was sold out.
Wow.
But he plans on going again. He's not going to stop. Of course, I don't know what's going to happen. The foundation certainly has to sort out what occurred yesterday before they move forward. But I hope that they go forth. And like I said, I'd go on another one.
Dan Lavallo. Dan, good to talk to you again, my friend. Thank you so much for your input. We appreciate it.
Paul, my pleasure.
Thanks, Dan. Be good.
Listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And for that, we thank you. We really do. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. You and I took history in school, obviously. I even took some of it in college. Had an elective or two. I took a couple of college-level history courses. Did a lot of history in high school and grammar school, junior high in history. I took American history. I did a study of China and Russia, American government, and all that. But our next guest says there is a conspiracy in academia and in populism and popular politics to kind of stop teaching what should be taught and to, in a sense, rewrite history. Name of the book is The War on History, The Conspiracy to Rewrite America's Past. Our guest has an interesting background, and we welcome to the program Jared Stepman joins us. And Jared, Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport. Jared, how are you?
Doing very well. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, somebody, a lot of people I know, good friends of mine, even some of my relatives, will say, ah, the war on history, the conspiracy to rewrite America's past. Oh, this guy is another right-wing nut who doesn't want us to own up to all the sins we have committed in the past and doesn't want light shed on these people that we worship that were such horrible human beings. And your answer to that would be what?
You know, my answer to that is, of course, I don't believe that the past is a perfect place. I mean, human beings are fallen, like, obviously today, just as they are at that time. But I think when you look at just simply what makes us unexceptional in this world, I think you miss the things that make us truly exceptional. And I think that is the inversion that we're seeing in history. I do think it's important to shed light on the realities of what has gone on in history. I think that's why it's so important to preserve the past as it is. At the same time, I think it's a good and just thing to celebrate the triumphs of what our country has done. And I think it has had an incredible record of success in its time in existence. It's such a remarkable one that it's incredible that there are fewer and fewer people now who can articulate and actually defend it.
Was there, Jared, for you, a tipping point that you maybe covered in your job at the Daily Signal, or you saw rolling out in front of you, or you heard from someone? What point was it that made you say, or at what time did you resign yourself to saying, I have to write this book?
You know, it started over kind of the debates that we've had over, you know, statues and monuments in this country. And of course, there was a very ferocious one over the Confederate statues in particular. But, you know, I saw how quickly that moved on to figures like Thomas Jefferson. And I mean, even today, George Washington, there's now a controversy over a mural in San Francisco. And I saw how quickly this debate really escalated. I mean, there just really is no limiting principle of putting essentially a ideological litmus test on people of the past and finding one thing that we don't like about them and saying, well, we need to destroy them, we need to cancel them. And I think that is what kind of prompted me to take a step back and cover the kind of great men and ideas in our country's past, who all of whom were flawed, but all of them contributed incredibly to what we are today, the prosperity that we currently enjoy, and that without them, this country wouldn't exist, certainly not in its current form, and certainly not with the success that it's had.
You know, and I'm sure you've tried to explain this, Jared. I know you do it in the book. I mean, look, nobody loved the idea of slavery as we look back on it. It was abhorrent that people actually owned other human beings. But at the time, we look back on it and say, how was that possible? But at that time, as we are doing things now in this time, Jared, that future generations will look at and won't be able to understand, these guys, these founding fathers, and they had some great women behind them too, for better or for worse, this was a norm in society that they did eventually move to get rid of.
Yeah, and they tackled it head on. I mean, it's incredible that in a society in which race-based slavery existed, in our founding document it says, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with individual rights. That is something that is incredible. And believe me, Jefferson and the founders, they meant those words. I mean, there are many who attack them as hypocrites and say that, well, they only meant one set of people, not another. No, they meant all human beings. And I think that's what made a folly of the system of slavery that we had in this country, which meant that 67 years later, that system would be eradicated forever. And that was a blessing to our country and to humanity. It's by their standards, though, that we judge that. And I think that's what was truly courageous about what they did, is looking at something that was flawed in their society at that time and setting it on the path to extinction.
What about people, Jared, who say, well, yeah, on one level, these founders or these people in history were very smart people, but the fact that they may have owned slaves and gave women very little rights, simply for that alone, they in no way should be honored. Sorry, but we are a more enlightened people now. What would be your response to that?
I would say that, you know, there is no limiting principle there then. I mean, any thing that we disagree with, even most recently, I mean, you could say, you know, President Barack Obama was in favor of gay marriage not too long ago. Now people say that that's important to be, you know, in opposition. You know, do they no longer want to celebrate him because he's on the so-called wrong side of history? A lot of these issues are very complicated, very much grounded in society. You know, if we want to look ahead in our future and say, well, how do we tackle the moral challenges of our own time? We should look to the past and say, well, how did people back then tackle something that was so ingrained that they saw as a fundamental wrong? Simply erasing them or eliminating them or saying they're no good does nobody any good and makes us less capable of judging those things in our own day.
Jared, you break the book down into individual wars, as you say, and you cite ideas, America itself, things we've done, attitudes we take as having war waged on it. Now, for example, and I know you've kind of touched on it already, but in your book you cite one thing now that's kind of going on, the war on the South, the Southern U.S., everything below the Mason-Dixon line. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I very specifically target, you know, the reunification after the Civil War. Of course, a lot of this debate over Confederate statues has been one of the most charged in all this, but unfortunately, it's bled over. I mean, some people say those are all just symbols of tyranny, but some of those things were symbols of reconciliation after the war. A lot of those statues are actually of defeated Confederate soldiers, and you know, the point that I make in my book is that it took a lot for this country to rebuild after the Civil War. It was a near miracle. It certainly wasn't done perfectly. But, you know, that kind of unification, that kind of forgiveness that went on both sides meant that a unified United States could move on to the 20th century, and that, you know, men from both the North and the South, East and the West would show up together side by side on the beaches of Normandy in 1944. That was because of people from ones like Abraham Lincoln, even to Robert E. Lee, who after the war was very much in favor of a reunification of the Union and rebuilding the charity between the sections. And I think that is essential to understanding our history.
Jared Stepman, name of the book is The War on History, The Conspiracy to Rewrite America's Past. And you know, Jared, I guess the bullseye theory of your book here is history's ugly. I mean, nobody has a pristine history. No country is free of blood and guts and racial or sexual orientation things that shouldn't have been done and just bad things overall. We have to face it.
We 100% have to face it, and I think that's one of the parts of my book that I emphasize. I think a lot of the people who are going after statues, they think, well, this will somehow cause racism to go away, this will cause oppression to go away, and frankly, that's just not the case. And if you do look at the long arc of history, it is filled with tyranny, it is filled with violence, it is filled with injustice. I think we've been very, very fortunate as Americans to have a society in which less of that has existed and has moved in a better direction. We are very fortunate we have things like the Declaration, the Constitution, but not just that. We're fortunate that we've had many people who believed in those things, who fought for them over the centuries, many of whom I think had a lot of views that we would today very much disagree with, but that's okay. And that's something that we have to grapple with. I'm sure that the generations that come after us will have much to disagree with us, and I would hope that they would have the foresight to understand that, you know, that they need to build off of what we've done, correct the things that we've done wrong, and not wipe out the past. Because, you know, if you wipe out your past, I think you ultimately end up with no future.
Jared, we understand we have you back here. I wanted to follow up on what you were saying, because you were perfectly leading into my next question. We all realize that. You write books like this, other people echo this, but again, it is the, I guess, Jared, you'd say the teaching establishment from grammar school and grade school to junior high to high school to colleges, isn't it incumbent upon them to impart this knowledge?
It very much is, and I think that is one of the things that most worries me. I mean, when you look at polls talking about civics, and civic knowledge in this country has declined incredibly. I mean, it's really stunning, especially when you go by generations. In these polls, it's mostly the oldest generations who have the most knowledge, the youngest who have the least, even though they just came out of our schools. You'd think that the memory of these things would be freshest, but that's just not the case. And unfortunately, a lot of our schools around the country, a lot of our history, a lot of information about civics is not passed along, and if it is, students are giving kind of a negative attacks on our history. And frankly, if you don't have a baseline to really understand, you know, what we are and where we've came from, you can't even really understand the attacks either, because you don't have a base of knowledge to even discuss the topic, which I think allows these kind of groups who, you know, simply want to attack statues to feel good about themselves or attack history. I think it just feeds into that climate and that kind of shutdown culture of, I disagree with people, I need to crush them.
Jared, in all the aspects of this problem that you write about in your book, The War on History, The Conspiracy to Rewrite America's Past, I know you just named it for me, but when people hear the word conspiracy, who would you say are maybe the one or two or three leaders of that? Are they individual people? Are they groups? Are they political entities? Who would you finger here as the top perpetrators of the problem here?
I think certainly one of the biggest ones is a historian by the name of Howard Zinn, who wrote a very radical book that got really popularized in the 1970s, but is now big at American high schools. But it's filled with factual inaccuracies, and it's an ideological history, and it's a very negative one. I think it's been discredited by many scholars across the political spectrum, but yeah, Unfortunately, it's used a lot in American schools. It's one of the most widely used textbooks, and I think we're also getting it from a lot of our higher ed institutions that don't teach, you know, things like, you know, informed patriotism these days. I mean, not even that word is considered offensive. And, you know, this should be the American elite, I think, has a duty to pass on these things. And we're really being failed by that. And I think that is a big difference from, you know, even not too long ago. And I think that's what's so worrying about, you know, our future. These ideas are not being passed along. A kind of anti-Americanism is.
And we see, you know, Jared, not only statues and what is taught in school, but, you know, we have the controversy. We had a controversy here in Connecticut at a couple of schools. My alma mater, Boston U, where, of course, Howard Zinn taught for many years, is going through this. The idea that certain speakers are now not even allowed to come on campus, or the groups that want to bring them in, largely conservative groups, they're given onerous rules as to how much they have to pay for security, what size the hall it can be. And I mean, that's just as poisonous as not teaching something in the classroom.
It is. I mean, our higher education should be about the free exchange of ideas. And the fact that a lot of our higher education institutions don't have basic First Amendment protections for students on campus, to me, is quite shameful. But more than that, it's the fact that these administrations are hostile to any ideas that may be different. I mean, that says a lot about these institutions. It shows the insecurity of a lot of the thinkers and the people at those places. And I think that's really leading to an unhealthy discourse in society. I think that's why there's such a big disconnect between higher ed and your average common sense American. And that's something that is toxic to our republic.
Name of the book is The War on History, The Conspiracy to Rewrite America's Past. You can pick it up on Amazon, wherever you get your books. Our guest, one of the editors at the Daily Signal, is Jared Stepman. Jared, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it. And good luck with the book. Hopefully we'll talk again. Thanks, Jared. Appreciate it. There you go.
Listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And we thank you for that. We really do. Paul Pacelli here behind the mic. Aaron Johnson on the other side of the glass. And we're at 203-333-9422. 203-333-WICC right here on WICC 600 on the air and online all the time, 24-7 for all your digital devices on WICC600.com. Well, we've had a proposal tossed out there. Nothing formal, but just an idea that maybe it's time to allow hunters to hunt black bears again in the state. This because of a close call on Sunday with a person who was hiking, was out for a hike here in Connecticut, and came into physical contact apparently with a black bear, escaped without major injuries. But there are a lot of people saying it's just a matter of time before someone possibly gets attacked. To talk about that, Watertown Republican State Senator Eric Berthel, who's one of the legislators who's encouraging the state environmental officials to okay some sort of a hunt. Eric, Paul Pacelli here. Good to talk to you again. How are you?
Paul, good afternoon. Always a pleasure to speak with you. It's been a while. And
yeah.
Thanks for having me on. I hope all is well with you.
It is. Thank you, Eric. And you and Craig Miner got together the other day and said, listen, you know, we love animals. We know they have their habitats. But this whole scenario now with the sighting and the, I guess, physical encounter the other day have to make us maybe rethink things about black bears here. Give us a little background here.
Yeah, so, you know, Senator Miner and I have been friends for a lot of years, and he is, you know, we joke that he's our resident, you know, bear expert in the caucus. And, you know, what I've learned from, not only from him, but from conversations with some of the experts at DEEP and just with people who understand these beautiful animals, right, that they are very territorial. A male will create a territory that is, you know, a certain number of acres and size, and they defend that. And they defend that territory against other male bears and against intruders. And the problem in Connecticut is that because we have not done anything really to reduce the size of the population or to control the size of the population, that, you know, there are more bears born, new bears born every year, about a 10% increase in the population. And we're kind of running out of space, if you will, in Connecticut for these bears to live the way that they are genetically programmed to live. You know, they're instinctually programmed to identify a territory. Within that male's territory, there might be three or four females, and, you know, life goes on, and the bears reproduce, and they have to expand. So what we're seeing in Connecticut now, and what we are seeing statistically proven to us by DEEP, because they record and track bear sightings in Connecticut, that this is no longer an issue that is affecting the quiet northwest corner or the quiet northeast corner. We have bears in Watertown walking down Main Street through our public school parking lots. We have them in West Hartford. We have them. I don't know that I've heard of a bear sighting in the city of Hartford yet, but the time is almost upon us. These bears need places to expand to, mm-hmm. and this is what they're doing. So that's kind of where we're at in terms of the population and why we're seeing so many more bear sightings now.
Yeah, you know, Eric, I was looking at a couple of community boards I belong to on Facebook last night, and I saw people discussing this, and obviously you get the immediate kind of blowback on this as well. They're just doing what they do. We can leave them alone. They leave us alone. But as you say, it's a numbers thing, and much the same thing, I think, Eric, when we discuss, you know, deer population. Near our major highways, there's so many of them that there's not enough food to go around for them, and a lot of them will either A, eventually starve and die, or attack a human.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And by the way, there was, you know, with the reference to deer, there was a deer that was actually caught in a fence on Capitol Avenue, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, that had to be euthanized because it had injured itself so badly. But here's a deer on Capitol Avenue in Hartford that has clearly come out of its natural habitat. That is not, you know, the urban center of the middle of Hartford is not the natural habitat for a deer.
No. I have not seen many wild animals on the 84-91 split.
You sure don't. You know, so I think that that's exactly right as well, and that is part of what is exacerbating this issue with the explosion of the bear population. And look, you know, one of the other things that people like to attack us on is that we're proposing an open season, and anyone who has a hunting license could go and take as many bears as they want. And that's just completely false. The legislation that Senator Miner and I proposed actually was going to be limited to just Litchfield County to start, and it was going to have a specific number of tags that would be issued by DEEP. Fully regulated hunt with the same requirements that hunters have to meet in order to hunt anything else that has a season, a hunting season in Connecticut. So it was not meant, Paul, by any means to say, let's eliminate the bear population in Connecticut. It was meant to maybe take about 10% of what we believe to be the population, which would then bring the population into control. Right. If we know they multiply and reproduce at 10% rate each year, if we take 10% of them out, then I guess the math would show that we would stabilize the population. And of course, you know, I've had a lot of people that have said some pretty unfriendly and hateful things about my work and Senator Miner's work, because they think we, you know, we don't love animals and we just want to let people who like to hunt go and hunt. And that's completely not true. This, I believe, as you alluded to, is a serious public safety issue now, and it's going to continue to get worse. And as you also alluded to, I do not want Connecticut to be a state where we have to have, you know, on a YouTube video, on a Twitter, tweet, mm-hmm. a picture or a video of someone being mauled or killed by a bear.
Yeah. Okay?
We have an opportunity to fix this now and do it respectfully. We have an opportunity to do it with full input from the legislature to control the bear population and do something that will essentially protect the public from what I think is becoming a bigger nuisance and is going to be a bigger threat as we move through time.
Eric, now, does this, what's the process for this? Does the General Assembly have to okay this, or can DEEP just order this? How does this work?
No, as is true with just about everything we do in the legislature, there would have to be a bill proposed. It would be considered by the Committee of Cognizance, which in this case would be the Environmental Committee, and then get voted out of committee, and would have public hearings and testimony, ultimately, ideally, get voted out of committee and then scheduled for a debate in the House or Senate, depending on whether it was a House bill or a Senate bill to start, and then would have to seek passage there in both chambers by a simple majority, and then, of course, off to the governor's office for a signature, and then it would become law.
So we're talking, Eric, about something that would be done after the current hibernation period, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and we would not have an opportunity to, obviously, to reintroduce any bills until we're back in session in February of next year, because that's when we'll go back to work.
You said that you have been receiving, unfortunately, some unkind words. I mean, that's unfortunate. And to me, that comes born out of ignorance. I'll say it if you don't want to use the word. But again, the people don't step back, take a breath, and understand the scientific and the zoological principles behind this.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, it's an emotional piece for a lot of people as well. They think that these bears are these defenseless animals upon whose territory we are encroaching upon. And I'll tell you what's emotional for me. You know, I live in Watertown. I live in a residential neighborhood. I don't live in the woods, you know, in the forest with a mile-long driveway or anything. And on July 11th, my wife and I were sitting on our porch. My kids are in the backyard. My kids are teenagers. My neighbor's kids are teenagers. But one of my other neighbors has babies, toddlers. And all of a sudden, I hear the kids yelling and screaming, kind of out of a little bit of fear. And across my backyard goes galloping a juvenile bear, about a 200-pound bear. But here he is running through the yard. And I got up instinctually, if you will, started making a lot of noise to scare this thing off. But this is not, you know, to me, this is not something that we should just easily say, oh, let's just live with it. And they were here before us. Or, we shouldn't be invading their space. That's ridiculous. This animal was out. It was looking. It's foraging. It likes to eat. That's primarily what these bears do, is they eat. Hey, yeah. How do I know that one of those children, whether it was my own or my neighbor's, could have been taken?
Or the infant or the baby. Oh, my God. That would be worldwide awful front page news. It would.
Exactly.
It would.
Exactly.
It would.
You know, it's just, so Paul, I think that we have to put some of the emotional aspect of these are cuddly, you know, Winnie the Pooh, Smokey the Bear animals. They're not. They're animals that are living in nature, and they're doing what they do naturally, which I started with, which is expanding territories and trying to survive. I think we have an obligation and we have a responsibility to the people we serve to ensure the public safety, and part of that is with a controlled hunt to keep that population in check. And let's see if it works. Maybe it doesn't work. Maybe it doesn't work.
No, you're right. You're right. And Eric, one of the things that drives me crazy, and you've heard this from your friends, obviously, and from the folks at Deep and your friends that know about this, like you said, Senator Minor, how often, Eric, do we hear people, and they've been saying it this week, seal your garbage cans if they're outside, wait till the morning of the garbage collection, bring them out before you go to work in daylight, and for the love of God, don't use bird feeders. Eric, I was on a Wallingford Town Facebook board where I live the other day, and somebody posted, Eric, there was a video. I don't know whether you've seen it. It's a video. Not one, not two, a family of bears in a backyard in Wallingford picking through, you know, like it was a buffet before the kickoff, you know. They were picking through a bird feeder, and people around there going, oh, how cute, that's awesome. Cute.
Yeah,
you know,
it's dangerous.
It's dangerous.
I fear that interaction. I've said this twice on the floor of the Senate when we have debated, because we've had these bills, but we actually get to the floor for a debate. And I've said it. I don't want us to be the state that makes international news for a bear mauling or a bear killing of a human being. I think we can do something respectfully with taking everyone's opinions and everyone's concerns about this in mind, and do something to begin to change what's going on here. This is only going to get worse. These bears are going to continue to reproduce, and the population is going to continue to grow. And the non-lethal methods, Paul, don't work. You know, they'll go and tranquilize these bears. They tag them, and then they put them all the way up in the woods, up in the north.
Doesn't work. No, they're smart enough. No,
they come back. They're smart enough to come back.
Yeah.
It's an interesting situation. We're going to keep fighting for it, and you know, that's all we can do. That's our job as legislators, to try to bring some common sense to some of what's going on up there.
Eric, in the 2 minutes we have left, I just want to hit you with this. What are you hearing regarding the toll situation? You know, they're still kind of pining for a special session. I don't think it's going to happen. We're hearing now, well, we're going to combine it with only the bridge tolls and maybe some low interest borrowing. Are tolls dead? Are they on life support? Are they, you know, are they like the phoenix? Are they going to rise again? What do you think?
You know, Paul, it's a great question. And as a Republican serving in the legislature, you probably know just about as much as I know. I'll find out about what the governor's proposal is or the Democrats' proposal is for some sort of hybrid of tolls and bonding and what have you, probably a few minutes before the rest of the world will. same kind of situation we deal with you know, sometimes with budget issues and whatnot. We're kind of the last to know. We're not necessarily, we're not invited to the table to work on those plans. So all of what you said is certainly possible. Is it probable? I don't know. I think there's a lot of a lack of appetite for anything to do with the nasty T word right now, tolls. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out and what we ultimately do. But I don't know that any Republican will have advance notice of what that plan will look like, which is really kind of a sad state of affairs for how we're running some aspects of the legislature right now.
Eric Berthel. Eric, thanks, man. We'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Enjoy your day.
Thanks, you too. State Senator, Republican Eric Berthel from Watertown, represents a rather large district around the Watertown-Waterbury area. Quinnipiac University law professor Bill Dunlap. Bill, how are you, sir?
Doing just fine. How are you?
Good, Bill. Good. Thanks for asking. Well, you're watching just about what we're all watching now. And, you know, last time we spoke about this, Bill, we were in the very early stages here. This has advanced somewhat. What's your gut feeling on this so far, where we may be heading?
Well, it certainly looks as if we're heading in the direction of impeachment. But I hope that the committees will be taking their charge very seriously, which is to investigate and see whether there are actual impeachable issues here. A lot of the talk seems to suggest that impeachment is inevitable. But in fact, as I see it, this is an investigation going on.
Yeah, Bill, and it's interesting, and I've talked to people about this. They say, well, impeachment is underway. And I say, no, what they've essentially done here, Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, but an impeachment inquiry, doesn't it just kind of put a fancy title pretty much on some of the stuff that was already going on?
That's one way of looking at it, I think. That there are certainly people, well, not just in the Congress or just on the Democratic side, but all over the country, who believe that there's a great deal going on that deserves impeachment, but very little of it is backed up by hard facts. And even the hard facts that we have are often subject to interpretation. And I think that's what these committee hearings are going to be directed at.
Mm-hmm. Quinnipiac University Law Professor Bill Dunlap joining us again. Once again, about the progress or lack thereof, maybe some see, with the impeachment inquiry. It's not a formal proceeding. Bill, you know what fascinates me is, and a lot of people, I guess, don't understand, when documents are subpoenaed by a congressional committee, either from the White House or from the State Department or the President or Secretary Pompeo, walk us through a little bit of the process of whether they have to comply here, and what if they don't? What would Congress do? How the courts are involved here? What's the bottom line on that?
Well, when one house or the other in Congress subpoenas documents, there is a legal obligation for the White House to turn those over as a general rule. But there are privileges that the executive branch can assert. There are two specific privileges that I think are likely to come up over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
One is generally referred to as the presidential communications privilege, and the other has to do with confidential conversations within the executive branch itself. The first one that I mentioned is a constitutionally based privilege.
Oh, really? Okay.
And the other is one that has existed in the common law for decades, centuries.
And I guess the feeling here, Bill, is that, listen, yeah, Congress has oversight here, but a president has to be able to be free, just as a business leader would, or as, you know, friends would, or any lawyer, you know, client would be able to just discuss things in confidence, right?
That's true, except when we're talking about business leaders or friends, we don't grant them this kind of privilege. A court, a prosecutor, can go after those conversations for records of them to see whether any illegal conduct was being discussed. but when it comes to the President of the United States and a few other very high-level officials, we do recognize that there are times that, for a variety of reasons, we shouldn't make that information public.
Bill, if this plays out, and I guess the focus now is, you know, this whole whistleblower thing and the fact that pretty much everybody is saying, well, you know, they want to hear directly from the whistleblower. And if this whistleblower, whoever him or her might be, if they got this, as the rumors are, second or third hand from somebody, that would that likely, you think, play out in a public hearing that would be televised, perhaps with this whistleblower's identity masked in some way? Or is this likely a very hush-hush, closed-door thing?
I can see it going either way. And I can see at different stages of the game each side of this, Congress and those pushing for impeachment and the president on the other side, changing sides and wanting either a full-blown investigation or keeping, a full-blown discussion, or trying to keep it as contained as possible. But I don't think the fact that the whistleblower got the information secondhand, that it's all inadmissible hearsay or however you want to describe it, if in fact the accusations in that memo are true, they need to be investigated. It doesn't really matter how the whistleblower found out about them. The question is, this should be turned over to an investigatory body, and we should find out whether or not they're true.
The other thing I saw, Bill, that was interesting, I saw an allusion yesterday to assuming that the House would, in this case, for case of discussion, impeach the president. There was a majority there, and they would send the charge to the Senate. I saw an interesting discussion yesterday at a major newspaper, from an opinion piece regarding what the scope of the evidence would be once it got to the Senate, and whether or not, Bill, it would be a broad scope where Republicans could bring in other things, whether it would be a narrow scope, or what power that Mitch McConnell and or the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court would have in that. What are your insights on that?
Well, all of that is going to be subject to the Senate rules, and the Senate rules can change. It generally takes a two-thirds vote to do it, but it is possible to change those standards. I think that Mitch McConnell and whoever else on the Senate leads this is going to have a significant input into the scope of the evidence that they hear. But I don't think that the Chief Justice is likely to have very much influence here. I think the Chief Justice, under the Constitution, presides over the impeachment trial of a president, primarily because the president of the Senate is the vice president of the United States. You would not want the person next in line to succeed an impeached president to be presiding over the trial. So they put the Chief Justice in there, and I think it's primarily a technical position.
A referee to make certain calls if he has to?
Yes, that's a good way to put it. And any calls he does make can be overridden by a majority vote of the senators. So in fact, I don't think he's likely to have that much influence. But as to the evidence that the senators are going to hear, most of the evidence against the president is going to come from members of the House, probably members of the Judiciary Committee, who will go over to the Senate and present the case and act more or less as prosecutors. And the president will certainly, I would think, be allowed to bring in a great deal of evidence, probably in many ways to try to undercut charges of the particular motive, what it was he had in mind when he said some of these things that we know he actually said.
Yeah, and Bill, just to recap your final thought. So in your mind right now, of what you've seen so far, and Lord knows how long this is going to go, weeks, months, maybe right up to the election next year, who knows? But in your mind, anything impeachable at this point, yes or no?
Well, I certainly think that some of the obstruction of justice charges could rise to the level of impeachable offenses, but we may want to know more about exactly what he did. I think perhaps the most worrying concern for the president should be this discussion with the Ukrainian president over trying to urge Ukraine to investigate Vice President Biden's son. That looks very much like trying to get another country involved in our presidential campaign. And I think on several levels, that could arise to an impeachable offense.
Bill Dunlop, professor, Quinnipiac University Law School. Bill, as always, thank you. I really appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. I hope so.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it. There you go.
Bill in Shelton. This should be good. Bill, you're on WICC. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
What's up?
Tell me, have you ever heard of this, you throw an Alka-Seltzer to a seagull and it explodes?
Come on.
That's what I heard. I've never done it. I'm tempted. You throw an Alka-Seltzer.
Come on.
That's what I heard. They explode.
You throw him away. You throw an
Alka-Seltzer to a seagull.
That's
it
just...
swallows it and explodes.
That's just wrong.
And about a pigeon, Tony said this morning that he was going on his way home to Stanford and hit his car underneath the bridge and put a dent in it.
Oh, really? Could be. All right.
He said that this morning on the radio.
All right, I got to ask him that. But Bill, all right, I don't want you to try it. But, so you're saying if you toss an Alka-Seltzer tablet to what, a seagull?
Yeah, they explode.
if the bird just takes off and goes in midair and blows apart?
I've never tried it.
Oh my God, Bill, thanks. That's just wrong. Oh my God. Aaron, do me a favor, look that up if that's real or not. Traffic and weather together on the sixes. You throw seagulls Alka-Seltzer tablets? They down them. They down them and they explode? That's just wrong. Sort of.
If it's happening in Bridgeport, the Valley, or Fairfield County, Paul is talking about it. Connecticut Today, WICC 600.
All right, we're talking about, I don't know how we got on this topic, but no, birds, that's it. Because I said, listen, leave birds alone. There's no reason you have to put out bird feeders. Birds will find foods. Don't put out the bird feeders because that's what attracts bears. Bears generally attack people. People can be killed. So if you put out your bird feed, you're going to kill somebody. How's that? If A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. Now, Aaron has been ever vigilant here. He's been researching stuff while we were on the break there. Now, Aaron has restored some faith I've had in humanity. You say this just the visual is funny. You say this Alka-Seltzer that blows birds apart is not true.
No, I found a comment here from a wildlife rescue and rehab researcher, and it said, seagulls don't blow up unless something that would cause an explosion outside of the bird's body is forced inside.
Like a shotgun.
Yeah, something like that. And the whole premise behind it was the fact that the idea was that seagulls are unable to pass gas. So that was the idea. So it was like if you gave them an Alka-Seltzer or you gave them some type of like bubbly soda, it wouldn't be able to handle it. And therefore, its digestive tract would burst.
So they don't fart.
Yeah, that's kind of the theory, but it was debunked in the fact that the bird can regurgitate food for its young, suggesting that it also reverses the direction of other things going down. So instead of passing gas one way, it goes through the other.
It goes through the got it.
Exactly. So
can I try Pop Rocks instead?
No, I think according according to this, it wouldn't really hurt it. Okay. It would just go out the other way. You know, better out than in, I always say, kind of thing.
So it could act as a natural break. If the bird is flying forward, it could shoot some of this stuff out. And that's kind of, instead of flaps down, you can just do that.
Yeah, and then it kind of goes backwards, kind of thing. Kind of like Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory when they started to descend because they started belching. Something like that.
Oh, God. Let's go to Ken in Fairfield. Ken, you're on WICC. Hi.
if I was going, yeah, most of the pigeons you're not going to get like up in the country because the hawks and the turkey vultures will probably rip them off. That, you mostly find those in the city.
Yeah, but they know a pigeon will never go to a bird feeder, right? It can't.
No, I mean, I don't know. I mean, just feeding the animals, I had a situation a couple of days ago with a coyote.
Yeah.
It was a pretty large coyote, and it was feeding on bread that the neighbor was throwing out. And it came back, and I was with the wife and the kids, and the thing came back and was laying down, and it started running towards us.
Oh,
and we walked back. We walked away. I don't know. There was like a pup litter with the coyote. I mean, it's another situation too. This is why you see a lot of the signs with the lost pet, like dogs.
Yeah.
These coyote packs are ganging up on these pets.
Oh.
I mean, not only black bears. I mean, I haven't seen a black bear in the state ever in my life, but the coyotes are becoming a problem, and I think that's going to become an issue as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Ken, thank you. Appreciate it. Coyotes we got now.
No, I'll go on there with it. What simpleton is feeding a coyote?
Look, we're going to feed the coyote. Get out. What is stomping?
This is not Looney Tunes. No.
Yeah, really. What's next? Look, honey, Roadrunner's over there. Meep, meep. That's what I would do. If I saw a coyote walking, I would just go, meep, meep. A freaking coyote. Let's go to Ed in Bridgeport. Ed, you're on WICC. Hi.
Yeah, how you doing, Paul? Yeah, I was listening to your previous caller. So.
Yeah.
They answered my question. They always told us that they would blow up if you gave terrible thing to do. But, yeah, if you feed them an Alka-Seltzer, they'll blow up.
I'm sorry. There's just a visual there that makes me laugh.
Yeah.
It's like a Looney Tunes cartoon, right?
Yeah. But I'm glad it's not true, though.
No, I know.
It always scared me that I would see somebody try to do that and blow the pigeon up. I mean,
the seagull.
Seagull right in front of me, and that would...
Oh, my God. Ed, thanks, buddy. Appreciate it. Oh, my God. Seriously, this last 10 minutes has been like a Looney Tunes cartoon, right? Me. How about an Alka-Seltzer, Doc?
Oh, sure, I want one. Yeah. I'll say, son, would you like an Alka-Seltzer?
Stick some what in the hot dog?
C4, apparently, in the hot dog.
Oh, geez,
that's
C4.
That's what he said.
Oh, stop it. I'm not going to say, no, we're not going to say who said that. Tongue in cheek. No, we had a caller call back. Jeez. Oh, my God. C4, folks, is a plastic explosive. Oh, I got to stop. We had a caller call back, tongue-in-cheek, not serious, yuck, 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 that you take a hot dog and you pack some C4 explosive in it. Stop it. Come on. We're just being funny here. We get. But again, all this happened in our youth. This all happened. Thank you. That's what the last 5 minutes have been on this show. Seltzer and a bird. See what happens. That's hey. That's what we've had here. The last 5 minutes.